To see examples of what we talked about on this episode, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
Two Dimension Podcast,
the comic book podcast
with no direction.
My name is Don Moore, and you're listening to Two Dimension, the comic book podcast with no direction. And sitting across from me is a man that needs no introduction, Mr.
Oh, Al. Mr. Al.
I got a list of quotes. I was looking up a quote, and then I forgot what it was, and I thought, well, it wasn't really that important anyway.
So here we are, back. It's been a while.
Yeah, vacations, this and that, and then you got to hear the younger half of the quad, the core four. And did you get a chance to listen?
I listened to a little bit of it, because I usually just listen for technical reasons.
Right,
the sound quality wasn't bad. It was all right.
Yeah, I don't know how he did it. What was strange was
Dallas. Because the one he did on his own a few weeks ago was not good.
He was holding his baby when they did that episode.
Oh, well, maybe that's why.
Yeah, well, I mean, no, this is the one when
with Rook.
With Rook. It sounded good, but
it did.
They brought up that they had the baby. Really? And
the
he was
baby
holding
was,
her.
Was, yeah, of course a baby would have been there. She was quiet.
Yeah, and then I guess at one point you could hear her make a little sound, which to me was a thrill, you know, because the only time I ever got to see her, she was sound asleep. But I thought, well, that's impressive. Good job, kid. But listening to the episode, I'll be honest with you, there wasn't too much they talked about that I knew what they were saying.
Yeah, well, like I said, I listened to a little bit of it. I listened to the whole thing. I saw, like, the listing of, you know, subject matters, and I'm like, okay, all right, okay, good.
The one thing they started...
Stuff we don't talk about, good.
Yeah. But one thing, the last show we did together, we were doing Pull-a-Palooza, and we pulled out Vampirella. And I, Vampirella was something I was aware of. Again, we talked about I first saw her on the Aurora Molokits, that comic book ad. And I knew there was a comic book of her. I'd seen the posters. I'd seen the Frazetta painting. I mean, I knew of her really well. But I'd never read an issue. And looking through it and talking to Al, I got a little more interested. So he sent me the second issue.
I didn't send you the first? I guess not. That's number two.
This is the second one. But there's a couple of things. One, I didn't know much about her except that she was a really neat looking character and
designed by Trina Robbins.
Yeah, I never knew that. And Forrest Ackerman
created it. Yeah.
Now one thing, and I do believe that one thing when I was putting the notes together on the I think it's the Wikipedia page, they list Jim Warren as the creator and Forrest Ackerman wrote it. But when I read that, all I'm suspecting is since he was the publisher, he took the credit for it. But I do believe Forrest Ackerman wrote it.
I mean, it's possible that Warren came up with the concept of a female host, but I think Forrest Ackerman did whatever he could. I read a few issues because now you dug my memory back. The first two issues are really weird of her story because they're written by Forrest Ackerman and they're just like a bunch of puns, basically.
Yeah.
And they're kind of goofy, but it establishes that she's from a planet of Draculon where blood is like water and the water's drying, the blood's drying out and these astronauts crash on there and like, you know, they fight her or whatever and she kills them and she drinks their blood and then she goes, oh, I'm going to get on this ship and go back to Earth because obviously they have a lot more blood there. And then that was the first two issues, if I remember correctly. Then it stopped for a while, so she was just hosting it. But then, like, by the eighth issue, Archie Goodwin took it over.
Yeah.
And then it became, like, a different story. She actually got on a plane, I think, and the plane crashed. And supposedly, like, when the plane crashed, they couldn't find any survivors. But whatever they did find survivors. Not survivors, but people. But they're all drained of blood. And then she's going through, like, she's like, dazed and going through this, like, the woods. And she ends up at some house, and it's a doctor who basically nurses her to back to health, but I guess Vampirella had wings that she hid, and he removed her wings, and then he invented some kind of fake blood, so she found out she was a vampire, and there was like a devil, it's real.
Well, Wow.
It's very convoluted. I'll have to send you the issues. I actually, as a matter of fact, I have them on the stick here. It's a very convoluted story, but the first two issues kind of set it up kind of like sketchy, and then Archie Goodwin took it over after that, and then Belle Dubay. But it has to do with, like, you know, there's a doctor and there's devil worshippers who want to destroy the world, and it's convoluted. I just read like 5 or 6 issues, but you'd be surprised at how.
Wow.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah, I read those a while ago. I remember you said you wanted to get into them, and it was almost like over a month ago. And that's what I remember, kind of, sort of.
But I guess there's a couple of things that throws me, and I've never said this out loud to anybody, but reading that Aurora comic book ad, the model, you know, and I saw Vamparola, what bothered me was, at this time I was 9 years old, and there was a girl in my fourth grade class, she was a heavy girl, and had big round glasses, but she kind of had that same haircut, and she was mean.
Oh.
And she'd go out, you know, she always had heavy shoes with high, you know, high heels and stuff with heavy soles, and she'd kick us in the shins, all the boys. And I remember one point all the girls had a beat up boys club. They just come in and start kicking us. You know, we're playing, you know, basketball or something.
Really?
And we'd go away, and they just kept coming at us. And so I started playing soccer on another end of the playground. You know, it's back when you had the free for all breaks. And I had no more trouble, but at one point in class, I was sitting at this one group of desks, and one of the girls said that they had a beat-up boys' club, and she was telling one of the tougher guys in the class, and his brother was in the other classroom. And she said, "We got a beat-up boys' club," and she named all the girls in it, which was the girls that was going after us. And then she said, "We kicked so-and-so, you know, and then we got your brother, we kicked him in the chin," which he was tall. I'm thinking, well, he must have been on the ground. Anyway, it was unpleasant memories, but the heavy girl was in that. She really loved going after people. Well, I don't know. It was like a month later at one point, a couple of the girls that sat by me were talking to each other. Said, "You know, I'm getting tired of the beat-up boys club. I don't want to do it anymore." And the other girl said, "Yeah, I never liked it." And then they mentioned the other girl I was talking about. Says, "Yeah, but she doesn't want to. She likes it." Well, she was horrifying. And so whenever I see Vamparella, I think of her.
Well, you know what? You're basically, that's funny you said that, because a couple of weeks ago on Slow Robot, we talked about what we call High School Hellcats, and it's basically about, it's from the 50s, about a girl gang. And I'm just wondering if they're like the mothers of those girls that you had in school, because it's about a girl gang that, like, I never really heard of much, going around, like, you know, grabbing girls and forcing them to be in the club, making them do all this stupid crap, and hanging out with delinquent guys.
Well, this wasn't anything like, they were fine girls, they were, you know, usually the girls are the better students in the class, you know. There was just that one girl that was kind of
beat up boys.
Yeah, you know, but they all started doing it. The thing was, none of the boys were attacking them or anything. We were just like, "Stop and go away," you know. And
none of the guys hit back?
No. And, you know, but you're getting kicked, and usually guys are wearing tennis shoes, you know. The girls are wearing, you know, boots and, you know,
wow,
platform shoes and stuff, and it hurts.
Yeah, but I would imagine, yeah. So that's what Vamparella looked like.
Well, then a couple of years later in middle school, that one girl that was so much trouble, she was really mousy. You know, she completely changed.
Really?
And, you know, I'd see her and stuff, but, yeah, she wasn't anything like that. It was just, I don't know.
Some of the face she was going through?
But when I saw the Vamparella, I thought, God, because of the haircut, you know, and I guess the thing was, you know, she was making fun of Frankenstein stealing that woman in New York City and nobody's helping her. Yeah, that's something this woman would do, or girl would do.
Wow, young high school, grade school Hellcats. God. Wow.
So Vamparella was never anything that
interested you.
Well,
not to mention, if your parents found them, they probably would be like,
yeah,
that was
out of the question. But one thing I didn't know, I thought Vamparella would be like that blue girl in the Charlton Horror Stories, you know.
Oh, Winnie the Witch.
Yeah, I thought she'd be like that, where she was kind of a Rod Serling, Twilight Zone kind of host. And In the second issue, she is. It was all a bunch of short stories that she just introduced and finished, and she had that kind of goofy banter that I'm guessing Forrest Ackerman liked.
Yeah, right. The puns. He was Mr. Puns or whatever. But then, like, they fleshed her out to a real character, and then some of the books were basically like her adventure. She basically hooked up with this vampire hunter guy, a descendant of Van Helsing, and they were like, you know, chasing all these, like, it basically, I don't remember the later issues, I didn't read them, I read the other stories usually, but it was basically like a bunch of Satanists or anarchists or whatever, they were trying to destroy the world, and they were chasing after them, they were trying to kill them or whatever. But you know, Vampirella, which I had forgotten, had wings, and when she was living in Dracula, and she could hide them, but the guy, when she came down here, he removed her wings. So I was like, oh, okay.
Were they bat wings?
Yeah, they were big bat wings. Yeah.
Wow.
He removed them when he found her or whatever. But it's an interesting story. I have the issues in here. You know, there's like, like you mentioned, in the first issue you get a story. I guess at issue two you didn't, but then I think in the third issue or whatever you get a little bit more of a story. And then it stopped till the eighth issue, and they actually got Archie Goodwin, a real writer, to come up with a story. So he did, and Tom Sutton drew it for a little while, and then the guy who drew it after that, Jose Gonzalez, did it.
Yeah, well, we talked about Jose Gonzalez, who is fantastic.
Yeah, he's fantastic, yeah.
The one thing you'd mentioned, I noticed it in that issue we were looking at, was that he's got a fantastic style, but every once in a while you said he was kind of cartoony.
Yeah, it was an interesting style.
And I was thinking, the cartoony ones, they look kind of like Jack Davis or Mort Drucker from Mad Magazine. I mean, it was still good, but it was strange how he would go from that to more of a...
realistic.
Yeah, this, the way the Spanish artists usually work. And and I'll tell you, he really draws really nice-looking, sexy women.
Oh, yeah. There's a few drawings in some of the issues when he would do like a pinup where, you know, it's obviously he had a model, but they were almost like, they were very realistic looking, you know. I mean, they weren't cartoony at all, but when he did his comic book style, I guess he was a little bit cartoony. And
yeah, he could switch. He was really distinct.
Yeah, yeah, he had a great style, yeah.
And one thing, I've never said this out loud either, but Al's a fan of Tom Sutton. You've always liked Tom Sutton.
Yeah.
I don't hate the man.
Take him or leave him, right?
Yeah, I'd rather leave him. I've never liked him. I'm flipping on that one now, because looking at that first Vampirella issue, I see why you like him. He's, there's two things. One, I like the style. It was kind of a unique, cartoony, smooth style he's got. But then I saw, looking up through the blog, I saw some other work he did for Vampirella.
He would change his style.
He could change it and change it well.
Yeah, he was very you know, like sometimes he'd do washes, sometimes he'd do like kind of even more stylized than that. And then other times, there's a couple of stories that he did where it was almost like doing a Kirby thing or whatever.
Yeah.
And there's one that he drew that I mentioned on my blog that I really like called Grub, that was written by Nicola Cuddy, and that had a really nice style on it. So he's a versatile artist.
He was a very versatile artist, and he had a grasp on it. You know, I've seen other people that worked in different styles. There's some of them that are really good at that, and there's some of them that just, you know, I don't know, jack of all trades, master of nothing. You know, Tom Sutton, it was always solid. He always had a grasp.
I mean, there was times when some of the stories looked like they were rushed a little bit, but I'm sure they were. And he just did it, you know, he had to get the job done or whatever. But when he took his time, it was really good work, man.
Well, sometimes whenever you mention Tom Sutton, you always call him Mr. Charlton, which is true. But a lot of the Charlton work, which is where I saw him at, it was solid, I guess, but you could see he was just knocking it out, rushing it. And, I mean, it didn't seem like there was a lot of inspiration. It just seemed like he was just putting it in, which, I mean, that could be good, too. Sometimes artists like that, if I like their past work, I appreciate getting to see more, and you see how he works, you know. It's like looking at sketchbooks. But I just found it kind of sloppy and half done to me. But looking at this other work, he was the real deal. He was something.
He was really good, and it was like he's one of those guys that back in the day you kind of took for granted because you were into you know, Jeff Jones or Bernie Wrightson or Kaluta or Frazetta. And he was just like another guy, but he was actually good, but he kind of got, you know, buried the next week. Now, as the years go by, you kind of look back and go like, hey, you know, his stuff kind of stands out in a weird... He was very good at drawing H.P. Lovecraft stories because he had kind of a weird horror kind of style sometimes. He was very good at drawing H.P. Lovecraft stories. So, yeah, he's definitely an underrated artist that definitely should, you know... But you got to, like you said, it's an acquired taste, yeah. I think is the word, you know?
Well, if you see the right work, I think you like him right off the bat. Those Vampirellas, I was surprised he did them. I mean, I could see the roots to it now. But when I said, wait a minute, this guy's, that's Tom Sutton?
And, yeah, because that doesn't look like the Charlton stuff.
No, it doesn't, but you can kind of, everybody kind of has their own kind of troops and footprint, signature, kind of how they do it. And it reminds me a lot of the work that I saw in Star Reach when I was buying those all the time.
He did some Star Reach.
Oh, well, that might be why.
He did some of those, yeah.
But like I said, when I was coming in, I was seeing, I'm guessing, a lot of the later work, and it was rushed work and stuff. Probably low pay rates, paid rates.
Charlton paid the worst, yeah. I think.
So he was putting a lot of stuff out.
I think Charlton was maybe like $40 a page for pencils and inks or something. Yeah. Or
what was the standard at the time?
Like it was probably more for pencils. I think for pencils it might have been $40 and maybe inks another $30 or $40 or something. So if you did both, you'd probably get like more like $60-$70. I think. I could be completely wrong. I'm just guessing. I mean, it's even possible that Charlton was paying $25 a page. I don't know.
I've always heard it was lower, and I always heard when Ditko worked for him, he just didn't want to have to deal with Marvel and DC and all their dictates.
I'll look it up after during a break or whatever. But yeah, they paid the lowest rates. Warren didn't pay good either. That's why they lost a lot of the guys.
That's what surprised me.
They did not pay good. That's why, like in the late '60s. People started leaving them because I think their business went down a little bit. Plus, it was a labor of love for a lot of guys, from my understanding. And then when Archie Goodwin left, a lot of them left with him. And he didn't have good pay rates, so then they started putting out a lot of reprints. And then, you know, Sutton was starting out, would work cheap. Yeah. Clerico would work cheap. Cologne would work cheap. And then if you look through the issues in the early '70s, they were using a lot of fanzine guys that were starting out, like Jones, Kaluta, he didn't do any work for him early on. Jones, Wrightson, Dave Cockrum did early work for him. People like John Fantuccio, I don't think he ever worked for, you know, Marvel or DC, but he was a fanzine guy. Yeah. Frank Brunner did a lot of work for him.
He was great.
Corbin started out working for him.
Yeah, I didn't know that. I've seen his work.
He was doing undergrad, but he started out working for him. Yeah. Oh yeah, because again, they were paid not much, but I know Charlton didn't pay much.
Well, yeah, you know? I guess Warren. I just thought because they were big magazines and.
Well, what they did was, if I remember correctly, again, as I'm remembering, anybody can correct me. They contacted the Spanish studios, and those guys worked cheap too.
That's just, yes, that was another one. I always figured if you're European, it was more money, but that was just a misconception on my part.
No, those guys were cheap. That's why that's why Warren, Skywald, all those guys brought them in. And then the DC went after the Philippines. I think they were cheap, too.
Yeah, they were cheaper. And then they started, after that, Marvel started using them. And that was, Comics Journal did a really good article on them in the, I think it was like 88. It was about the state of Filipino comics. And one criticism they're saying was that when the American market started pulling their top guys, it kind of hurt the Philippine comics market was huge. I'm sure it still is. Everybody read comics there. But they said that kind of hurt when Alfredo Alcala and Nestor Redondo and all these, you know, major guys left. But I don't think they were just cartoonists. I think they were businessmen. I think they published their own work and everything else. They ran their own studios. And they came over and they said, you know, and that continued. One of those Image guys was a Filipino artist. Wills Portacio, I think.
Wills Portacio, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, which I guess he went back to the Philippines and had a studio and a school.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
I don't quote me on this stuff, but I think...
Nino.
Yeah, Alex, he's my favorite. Which one was your favorite of all the Filipino artists in the 70s?
I guess Tony DeZuninga.
Yeah, he was a great one.
And Alcala.
I mean, when I say that, yeah, Alcala, I think that was most people's favorites. I think he was always like the elder statesman of all of them.
Yeah.
And he was good. He was never quite my favorite. My favorite was always Alex Nino. I always liked
Nino. Yeah, he was surreal.
Yeah, I just always loved his stuff, and I never really read a series. He was always kind of doing a few stories here and a few stories there. And I remember a Heavy Metal. There was one issue where they had some of his work on a cover, and there was a book. It was a trade I'd gotten. And I guess it came out in the 70s, but I bought it in the early 80s. It's called Sorcerers. And it was a strange book because they had a bunch of fantasy artists. I can't remember these men's name now, but I used to see their postcards and stuff all the time in these shops. But Alex Nino had a section. And God, they were just brilliant. And Jack Kirby was in it, and so was Jim Steranko.
Okay.
And I remember my friend Britt, you know, huge Kirby fan, extremely huge, you know, Steranko fan. And I remember Steranko, each one, it's kind of like the studio where you introduced yourself and then showed your work, told your philosophy. And in Steranko's section, it says, looking through all the people I'm in the book with, I'm the most commercial. And proud of it, you know, and then explained about commercial art and his thoughts on it, which, you know, that's how Steranko was. And I showed it to Britt. And later, Britt said, I said, what do you think? He goes, well, it's good. He says, I think Kirby and Steranko were like sore thumbs in this book. Well, it's true. You know, a lot of the guys were more like that Brian Froud kind of fantasy illustration type.
Oh, like the Brothers Hildebrandt or something?
No, they weren't then, but Brian Froud, who did that book Fairies.
Yeah, kind of. I sort of remember it. Sort
yeah,
of.
He designed Dark Crystal, that Jim Henson movie.
Oh, okay. All right.
And I was a big Brian Froud fan. But it had a natural look to it, like natural artwork and stuff, the natural world with fairies and stuff. But it was great. But Alex Nino was in it, and that was the reason I bought it. I thumbed through it. Wow, look at this. And I bought it. He always made you think of grand things, you know, but anyway.
What I remember of him mostly back then was that it was in one of the Marvel magazines that Harlan Ellison, Repent, said the TikTok man or something
really?
Like that.
Really? I don't know that one.
Repent Harlequin said that it's a very strange story, and Nino made it even stranger. But the thing about Alex Nino is that I really appreciated his work. But number one, I found it a little bit hard to read sometimes. And number two, I didn't ever want to draw like him. So it was kind of like, okay, yeah, that's nice. He's a great artist. But I never really studied his work that much. Mm. It was like, I don't really want to draw like that. But it's really cool, though, you know. So, yeah, I love his work.
See, here's the thing with me. I couldn't draw anywhere like that. I was always the polar opposite of anything he'd ever put out. But whenever I see his work, I try to draw it in my style, which never worked. But I just, when I saw him, I just always loved his stuff, and still do when I see it. Just fantastic. I said all the Filipino artists were great, but I never liked Rudy Niebres. And the reason
I liked his work.
Well, I see it now, and some of it is just fantastic, but the reason why I didn't like him was, when Gil Kane was doing John Carter, the first issue was embellished by Dave Cockrum. And, you know, they were using Dave Cockrum's designs and stuff for the book. I love Dave Cockrum. At that time, Dave Cockrum could do no wrong for me. And then I bought John Carter. I loved it. I remember the Weird Worlds that DC put out. Man, this is great. Bought the second issue. It was Gil Kane with Rudy Niebres. Rudy Niebres, man, he leaves a super heavy footprint. I mean, it doesn't matter.
So is Alcala.
Yeah, so all the Filipino artists.
So is Niebres. Rudy, not Niebres, so the other guy.
Alex Nino.
No, the other guy that's really good that we didn't mention that did the Bible book, Redondo.
Yeah, Nestor, he's one of my favorites.
He's real strong inking style.
Yeah, they have a heavy-handed approach to it. But Rudy Niebres, I don't know, to me, it seemed like while he's inking, he just kind of let the ink bottle spill all over the page. I mean, I guess it was control, but it was harsh. And like I said, I still want Dave Cockrum, and he inked it. But I've seen his drawings, and his drawings are really nice. And I've seen inking restraint on them, you know, which I never saw before.
Yeah,
so, yeah, but I mean, I used to just, my blood pressure would go up when I think of Rudy Niebuhr when I was younger, but that was why. It was just the context that.
Well, the thing about the Filipino art, as much as I like them, I just remember, and going through, somebody sent me, a friend of mine sent me a bunch of issues of whatever DC horror book, House of Mystery or Secrets, and you're looking through them, and you go through, you know, the early days into the late 60s, and you start getting the guys you like, you know, and the old guys who Bill Kane writes and all those guys. And then about 72, here comes Alfred Alcala and Dazen and guy. This isn't too bad. And then it was like, we're taking over now. And that's what they took over pretty much all the mystery mags. So I stopped reading them. I mean, I liked their work, but I wanted to read other people. And then the Warrens got taken over by Spanish artists, which were nice, but, you know, I mean, I just wanted to read the guys that I grew up with, you know, who the storytelling that I remember, like Wally Wood, or, you know, like I said again, Wright St. Jones, you know, Reed Crandall, you know, Dave Cockrum, Corbin, or whatever. I wanted, because the storytelling seemed to be different, and the drawing was more, I don't know, it was something. The Filipino stuff was really nice, and the Spanish stuff was really nice. The Spanish stuff was very illustrative and almost took away from the story. And the Filipino one stuff was nice, but I don't know. You know, it was kind of like there was a few years in there where they just like took over. And then like later on, like by the later 70s, it was like, you know, they were doing Conan, like Ernie Chan.
Right, right.
You know, they're mostly doing Conan and a few things. But in that era, man, it was just like, oh my God, especially DC. Horror, every book was like Alfred Alcala.
So oh, yeah.
Just give him the entire book, you know?
Well, there was at one point.
And he was very good.
Yeah, there was at one point Ernie Chin did almost every DC cover for a while.
And he did all the Conans for a while. All the black and white books. It was like every month it was Ernie Chin inking somebody to make it look like John Buscema.
Yeah. Well, I liked it when he inked John Buscema. He was my favorite John Buscema inker, you know, with Ernie Chin.
I liked the other guys better than him, but he was all right. He was good.
But
he did Claw, right? Ernie
Chan. Yeah.
He was Ernie Chua before he was Ernie Chan.
Yeah, I never quite understood that. Ernie Chua was, for me, hard to actually say. He's like, well, what's the rest of his last name? And then they made it Chan. I never quite understood that. I didn't like Ernie Chan's drawings, per se. His inking, it depends on who he inked. Like I said, a heavy footprint. But his covers, I don't know, I always found them stiff, and I always found. And I like Claw. That was my favorite work he did by himself. But it seemed like he made his arms and legs too short for the people's bodies. Like it was
the. You know, we talked about it.
Yeah. The forearms and the, you know, all the arms are just a little too short for it. Which, I mean, I said every artist has their own thing of making too long or too short, but. It seemed like the head, the chest, you know, the waist and all that, the trunk, it was always okay, but then they had these short little legs and arms attached to him. And he always had a stiffness to him, like he was fighting composition.
Yeah,
And, but I don't know, again, his inking, it was heavy rendered, but it seemed like after a while he started getting a little more disciplined with it, like he was holding a little more restraint to it, which I appreciated.
Now, we were always incorporate Pablo Marcos in with the Filipinos, but he's not. He's from Peru.
Yeah.
But he came in around the same time, so whenever I saw his work, I always kind of incorporated it with them, but he's not. He's a different, completely different.
See, it's funny because I just always put him with the American artist. I mean, I know the name Pablo Marcos isn't, you know, a standard American name normally, but we saw him at MegaCon. He signed some books for me.
Yeah.
And I guess what surprised me, I wasn't expecting to see him so young. You know,
he looked pretty young.
Yeah, I thought, you can't be Pablo Marcos. I was a kid when you were winking. And he was on the phone.
I remember him being on the phone.
He was on the phone, and it wasn't like blowing off. It seemed like whatever was kind of important, you know, and he's speaking Spanish, which I didn't know what he was talking about. But when he saw me, I brought three books, and he very graciously, you know, he signed each one for me. And then, you know, while he's busy, I give you props for that. You know, I liked your inking.
Yeah, I wish I would have brought some books for him, but I didn't even think about it, you know. Did you get an autograph by Perez and Marcos?
Yeah.
You did. That's
yeah,
cool.
Well, my favorite work he did was on George Perez. He was my favorite George Perez inker. And I just loved it. And he did those Avengers issues, you know, especially the ones where, what was it? The Grim Reaper shows up and puts the Vision on trial because, you know, Wonder Man was back. Those issues Perez drew and, you know, Pablo Marcos inked were second to none. I remember in the letters pages in that, people were writing into it, and they said, yeah, we've had to, after reading all these letters about the artwork, it says both George and Pablo's had to change their hat size three times. Oh, rightly so. And so those were the issues. George Perez, my friend Melody got him to sign them, and then when I found out Pablo Marcos, I brought those issues in for him to sign.
Oh, so you got both of them. Yeah. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it meant a lot to me, and I would have liked to have talked to him, but he didn't seem like, regardless of what was going on, he probably wouldn't have been that interested. But to me, if you got something that seemed really important you're dealing with, and some guy comes up and you sign the books and you didn't make me feel like I was in the way or rushed or anything, hey, I love you more, man.
Yeah, I know a lot of people that didn't like his work, but I always did, kind of. I mean, it wasn't my favorite, but then again, it's like nowadays, it's like I'll go back and look at this work and I go, yeah, you know, it was really good. I should have been giving it more, you know, props, but yeah. I didn't at the time.
Yeah, but not everybody is going to like every artist. I mean, you and I, there's artists we both like, but then there's other ones where I love and you don't, and vice versa. I remember one time I bought it was a Marvel comic. It was King Cole, but I don't think it was a King Cole title. I think it was, you know, one of those Marvel spotlights or something. But it was, you know, the regular four-color comic. I said, he's back. And he was no longer king. I guess some other guy was king and he's trying to get his throne back, but the cover was drawn by Pablo Marcos. And it was nice. I thought, wow, he draws as well.
I remember Severin's doing those.
I love those.
John and Marie Severin's. Those are beautiful.
Yeah, I've bought those. I was buying those every time I went to convention.
I remember those.
It's because in one of those Bizarre Adventures or something, you know, those Marvel magazines, the back, they had that portfolio of of King Cole by the Severins. They had like seven plates. And I just love those. And
I remember that, yeah.
I love John Severin because of Crack Magazine. I always loved, you know, Marie Severin. And when I found out, I said, man, this is nice. And then I found out they did those. It was in two different books. They did, I think one was Cole, the Conqueror. And the other one was something like, again,
Creatures on the Loose or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, because I saw one today. Yeah, I think it was Creatures on the
because
Loose.
Because I was going to conventions and I bought every one of them that they did. And I was buying those and I was buying all the Frank Thorne Red Sonjas.
Yeah.
And that was the same thing. She was in another comic book.
Yeah, and Marvel's Premiere or something.
Yeah,
something like
Marvel Spotlight, something.
Yeah, one of those, yeah.
And I remember the first issue was drawn by Dick Giordano, and then there's an Esteban Morodo story in
those
the back.
Those are nice.
Yeah.
Those got reprinted in Savage Sword of Conan, yeah.
And then the second issue, again, was Frank Thorne. And, I mean, you know, Roy Thomas and I think Claire Noto wrote them, and then Frank Thorne drew them. And then they did so many issues, and then she got her own title. And, again, it was the same creative team. So I was buying King, you know, Cole the Conqueror and Red Sonja in two different books. That was fun times.
Were you buying Conan too at the same time?
Yeah, they were Conan me out. They were doing Conan.
Yeah, they sure
they were doing
Roy
King
Thomas
Conan.
Is, yeah, King Conan, Savage Sword, Savage Tales.
Yeah, and it was one of those points where you think, why am I getting all these? I mean, I really like the Conan comic book.
The art was
book.
So nice on.
Yeah, yeah, but King Conan, after a while, I was getting kind of tired of, you know.
Sutton did some of those. He inked either Gil Kane or somebody on some of those. King Conan's, or no, well, no, it was the annuals. I'm sorry, I'm getting them all confused.
Yeah.
There's so many.
That's one of my favorite Conan stories, is the one where Gil Kane drew it, and John Buscema said drew some, but I couldn't tell what he, it was mostly Gil Kane, and Neil Adams inked it. And I guess he added drawings too. It was the one where, it was published in those Marvel Treasury editions, republished. But it's the one where he missed, where was he from?
Conan?
Yeah, Sumeria.
Sumeria or Aquilonia?
He missed Sumeria, and he was remembering this girl he knew there. So he went back to Sumeria, and by this time there was raiders that took over the place, and they were wanting to take her, and she wouldn't have it, so she stabbed herself in the heart, and then Conan shows up, and she died. And she said, I kept telling him you'd be back, and I was right, and then she died. And I'm like, why did that have to happen?
Yeah, those stories are a little... Well, that's the thing, too. It's like, to me, it was like, back in that era, because we did a show about the barbarians, a lot of the better people, in my opinion, it could be completely wrong in some other person's opinion, went to do that kind of stuff. Burroughs, it went, and there was kind of Burroughs and Howard. And then just like everybody else was doing the mainstream books, and they were like, okay, but I kind of gravitated toward the black and white books. I thought the better artists were doing them, in my
opinion. Yeah, they were. Boy, John Buscema did a lot of those too, though.
Oh, God, yeah.
That's what blows my mind. He's doing that monthly Conan book. Besides, I mean,
he was doing a lot of layouts, I think.
Okay. But he was doing a lot of the Conan books on the magazines too, and they were nice.
He was doing Fantastic Four, Conan, the Savage Sword stuff. Yeah, what was it? I looked it up about a month ago. I went through a month of Marvel, right? In 1970, let's say four. I can't remember the exact date. And I'm not kidding you. I'm going to screw it up a little bit. Sal Buscema did four books.
Yeah.
Okay? Either the layouts or whatever. He had four books. Don Heck had three. Two pencils and one inks. Who was the other guy? Bob Brown had three books. And I forget what. So these guys were just cranking the work out, man. It was incredible. Sal Buscema was probably doing as much work as Kirby was in his prime. Not as great, but, you know, he was doing it. You know, so you wonder how these guys could get all this stuff done or whatever, but they did. You know, these guys were workhorses.
Yeah, but at the same time, I will say they were kind of, in my opinion, substandard compared to it. I've seen some Sal Buscema books that I thought were breathtaking. But there weren't very many of those. Most of the time, it's just kind of knocking them out.
You know, they're solid. They tell a story, and it's done in a workmanlike format, and it's readable, and it's kind of good. So I don't mind it. But you know, he wasn't as flashy as his brother. Let's put it that way. He suffered in comparison to his brother.
Yeah.
But he had a similar style. More cartoony, maybe, you know, maybe a little lighter, maybe.
But he did a lot of layouts and breakdowns, is what he was doing.
I mean,
it wasn't, to me, that wasn't really.
And if somebody like Klaus Janson got the book, it would look really nice.
Yeah.
And if somebody like Vince Coletta got the book, it would look good, but it wasn't as nice as if Dick Giordano or Klaus Janson or Tom Palmer got a hold of it, because those guys were stronger, you know, brush guys or whatever, so. You want to take a break?
Yeah, let's do it.
And play something?
Play something.
Like you, and slayed alive. I'd be there by the morning. You have changed like me.
You can hear our most recent 20 episodes on iTunes. If you would like to hear our older episodes, you can find them on our blog. Just go to bunchofdorks.com and click on the Cyclops.
And we're back. That was our friend Steve Robinson, who's not too happy about the Brexit and not too happy about Iceland beating England and humiliating them. And he's not too happy about what's going on in American politics right now. And all that told him was, Steve, the world went to pot when we lost David Bowie. David Bowie was the fabric that holding the universe together, and nobody knew it till he was gone.
Not just David Bowie. We lost Elvis's guitarist this week, Scotty Moore.
Yeah, Elvis' guitarist.
Yeah, he was pretty much like one of the standard guys that everybody, you know, kind of copied from for rock and roll. Him and Chuck Berry and a few others. Yeah. And, Scotty Moore passed away, so.
Yeah, I always liked Scotty Moore quite a bit. That was another story. Him and Bill Black. What was that? It was Bill Black, wasn't it? The bassist?
I think so. And there was the other guy that was the guitar player for, what's his face? Bebopalula. Gene Vincent.
Yeah.
Cliff Gallup. He was another influential guy. Again, along with Chuck Berry and all that.
You know, one thing I want to point out with Scotty Moore and Bill, I want to say Black, but I can't be his name. The bassist for Elvis.
I'll look it up.
They were a different style. I mean, they weren't rock guys. They became rock guys.
They were country guys or something.
They were country guys, and I don't think they particularly cared for Elvis at first. You know, it was a big change. And it's like anything, once they started working with him and playing with him, they started appreciating what it was. And they say that the bassist was kind of a clown. Like he had a stage persona, you know, kind of a cut up and stuff. And there were times where Elvis couldn't quite catch the audience, and the bassist would pull the show out.
Really? I didn't know that.
But they would, he had learned it from another performer, another bassist. And, but that was the thing, sometimes is you can, you know, in a world of algorithms and stuff where they try to pair up everybody, like all these dating sites, you know, and they're trying to go by interest, and if your algorithms match up with each other, it could be good, but a lot of times what makes the world interesting is when people don't match up.
That's all right. That's exactly right.
You know, and we always say this. I remember Rook brought this up, that if anybody sent her a comic book and had the four of us read it, you're going to get four completely different opinions. You know, we don't all read the same books. You know, we all like comics. But that's the thing, with Elvis, that first band, and I think after those guys stopped playing with him, I think that's when, to me, the music wasn't as good. Sometimes you get people completely like-minded and the same thing. Maybe it's more pleasant for everybody, but it may not be as interesting.
Well, I mean, the opposite would be like the Beatles, Lennon and McCartney. They were kind of like-minded.
Yes.
And that came out really good.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, when I say that, that was one where they just melded. I mean, you could go either way.
They were different personalities, though.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And they had different approaches to things. But
you know what it's like? It's like getting to comics. It's like, you know, who thought that, like, you know, Sal Buscema and Klaus Janson would be such a great combination? Well, I mean, you know, sometimes that happens, you know, and sometimes, you know, it doesn't, you know, like, again, back in the old days or whatever, when comics were actually inked by different people as opposed to now where it's pretty rare.
Well, sometimes there's still different inkers.
Yeah, there are. There are occasional different inkers, but usually it's the same guy pretty much or whatever. And I'm trying to find Elvis Presley's band, but, you know, I can't.
Just type in Elvis, Scotty, and Bill.
Yeah.
That'll tell you.
It probably is like, you know, yeah, Scotty Moore. He was, God, you know, it was like you read about him and he's 84, you know, and you're thinking that he's probably, you think that he would be a lot older.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, and these guys, and they did look older than Elvis when you read about him or whatever, you know, so, well, let's see here. Let's see what it says here. Basically, he's just talking about, Scotty Moore. But anyway.
But Sam Phillips was the one that put them together. And it was just kind of funny when you read about it because they basically just came in to help him out on a couple of recordings. And then next
thing
you know.
Well, that was the Sun Sessions.
Yeah,
with,
which were, to me, my favorites.
With Johnny Cash and Jerry Lee Lewis and,
and Roy Orbison.
And Roy Orbison, or Chet, Carl Perkins and people like that. Yeah. Let's see here. I know James Burton was an Elvis guitarist, but he's also the guitarist for Bill Black. You were right. Oh. Bill Black, Scotty Moore, and DJ Fontana.
Yeah, he was the drummer that came later.
Yeah. They were session guys, yeah. Yeah, I like Elvis's work, but I'm not like an aficionado or anything like that. But I do appreciate it a lot. You know, yeah, Bill Black, man. And there was like the Crickets, which were Buddy Holly band.
Texas.
Which at one point, believe it or not, I think Waylon Jennings was one of the Crickets.
Towards the end.
Yeah, so anyway. Good. Enough music talk, even though we do have the little music icon now.
Yeah, because of Rook.
Because of Rook, yeah. So you're going to talk about something. So.
Well, I just ran across this yesterday. I don't know why. I just been kind of... You and I talked about old Jungle comics, you know, from the Golden Age.
Oh, my God. I love them. I just posted one.
I do, too.
Judy of the Jungle.
Yeah. Well, I keep looking at more because there's just something about jungle women that all look like Rita Hayworth.
Yeah. Oh, was the one that I had some scans of, and they were really nice. It was when Marvel remade Shauna, the She-Devil, in the 70s.
Yeah.
They were drawn by Ross Andrew, but they were really nicely inked by Vince Coletta, who always was good at inking women because of the romance kind. So those were really good. I really do like those, but yeah.
But like Sheena, Queen of the Jungle, she was always my favorite. They say she was the first of the female Tarzan knockoffs.
Probably.
But man, there's so many of those jungle women.
I know. And, I love them.
A mutual friend of ours is from Colombia, and when she found out we like comics, she started remembering, radio shows and comics that she liked in Colombia. But she remembers Calimont, the guy with the turban.
Yeah.
But then she started remembering all these jungle men. I said, these are all like Tarzan, but they all had different names. There's one, it starts with a K.
Korak was his son, wasn't he?
Korak's son. But there was a guy in the South America comics, I'll post it, I can't remember his name, but she always, to her, that's the one that she always goes to. But for some bizarre reason, the jungle women, the old comics of the Golden Age, they just fascinate me.
Because Matt Baker drew them beautifully. And that one that I just posted, it was a book called, what was it? It was called Exciting Comics, and it was by Standard, and it had the Black Terror, and then one of them was Judy of the Jungle by Ralph Mayo, who later on went to do a lot of work with Al Williamson, or some work with Al Williamson. Really nice, man.
Yeah, they're
kind of, it's, borderline stereotypical with the natives, won't call it racist, I'll call it stereotypical.
But I'll tell you something. I was reading, what was that guy, Arnold, I think it was Arnold Roth. He was in Comics Journal, one of the upper echelon.
I watched Antenna TV's playing Old Carsons, and Arnold Roth was on an episode.
Yeah.
And he was doing cartoons right on the spot, too, for
Carson. Yeah, and Harvey Kurtzman used to go on and do it when I was in college.
Oh, I didn't know that. Kurtzman was on The Tonight Show,
a lot, quite a bit. When I was towards the end of high school and beginning of college, he would be on there. And Johnny Carson always started off with a signature with the little Kurtz man. And, well, you may know this guy, and he does it for Playboy. Of course, I wouldn't have read Playboy, but I remember that signature. I couldn't figure why. It was from Mad Magazine, the comics, the old comics. And, but anyway, I don't know if it was Arnold Roth or it was David Levine. It was one of those guys that, drew for The New Yorker or something. But somehow Tarzan came up, and he just rolled his eyes and said, Tarzan, it's just the most racist comic, and it says it's trying to show white male superiority, he lives in the jungle, but he's better than all the black people. Well, I never took it that way. None of the black people were raised by apes like Tarzan was. but after reading that, it kind of changed my whole thing. And then I started thinking, I always loved that movie Lawrence of Arabia. I'm thinking, well, is this another one? Of course, I found out that was true, and it wasn't quite the same. Okay, well. So I've gotten real skeptical about white guys in other worlds that do really good.
But jungle women, though.
Yeah, but jungle women. But I don't know.
That's different.
Anyway, last night I was just on the internet, and I was again looking for jungle women. And then I found someone I never heard of, and I can't stop thinking about Senorita Rito.
Oh,
Rio.
Yeah. There was one called Rio. Yeah. That's great. I love those books.
It was from Fight Comics. And
the thing about it is everybody says, we need more women in the media or whatever. If you go to those old Golden Age books, there was tons of female.
There was a lot.
Superheroes.
But this one, it says, Senorita Rio, I have trouble saying that, Spy Sleuth, Risks Unlimited, Tiger Girl, and many others.
Tiger Girl.
But it's the woman in a red evening gown that's torn off at the bottom.
That's beautiful.
She's climbing down a rope ladder with a pistol. And there's a man with a hook at the top with a green face. Another guy inside this pit of cheetahs or leopards. And she's going down there, and she's the center. And she's, again, beautiful, like Rita Hayworth. And then who is this? Fight Comics from
40-something.
Yeah, 46. Number 46, 10 cents.
Fantastic.
And then there's another one. This time, she's in a, Spanish-type, blouse and blue dress.
Yeah.
fighting with foils on top of a rooftop against some guy with a dagger and a sword. And she's just, again, just as beautiful and composed. And there's a guy behind her climbing up on the roof. I don't know if he's going there to help her or help the guy, but it says same thing. Señorita Rio in Horace's Hacienda. Also, Captain Fight, K.O. Kirby, Tiger Girl, and many others. Tiger Girl, again, was one of those jungle
ones. I think, if I remember correctly, I think those were like 50-page comics, too. They were like bigger books.
Well, I just saw these two covers, so...
I'm going to post some of those on...
I thought, man...
That's a nightmare.
These... One, she's pretty. She's not... When I say this, and I like these, too. She's not a woman in a skimpy outfit. She's not a big-breasted woman that's walking around. That, you know, I mean, she's a nice, beautiful lady that climbing in a pit of leopards with a gun, a pistol, fighting men on rooftops with swords. I mean, that's awesome.
There's a lot of those, man. A lot of the patriotic free women, too, you know,
yeah.
I know there's a few of them that I remember seeing, and... But there was a lot of jungle women, a lot of them.
Yeah, the jungle women are always my favorites. But this one, it says she was in Fight Comics 19 to 68, and then later 70 to 71. But her name was Rita Ferrara, was at one point a rising Hollywood actress and a formal movie stunt girl. When her fiancé, Bill, was killed in the attack of Pearl Harbor, she decided to become a secret agent in hopes of saving other American soldiers from a similar fate. She faked her own suicide in Rio de Janeiro while attending the premiere of her new film, Lady Dance No More. Taking the codename Señorita Rio, she soon became the Queen of Spies, battling Axis agents throughout South America. She was a skilled dancer, singer, and actor. She can mimic voices very convincingly. That's kind of cool, actually. She's said to be a fighting stock, was extremely athletic, capable of performing amazing feats almost effortlessly. Anything from diving off the side of an ocean liner to catching someone while swinging on a trapeze. She is like the perfect woman. She was an expert fighter, skilled in jiu-jitsu and fencing. She was proficient with firearms, including heavy machine guns, and a good enough marksman to shoot a man's gun out of his hand. She usually concealed a handgun on her person, as well as tools for escape. Presumably, she was fluent both English and Portuguese, and possibly Spanish and German as well. Well, yeah, I mean, there was a lot
more.
Who
says they weren't women role models back then?
Yeah, well, there was a lot of female characters in the Golden Age.
There were. It just after that, it became a bunch of guys.
You know, but I guess it's fascinating because, one, I like the fact, I've only seen two covers. I never got to read any of her stories, but definitely a woman. And again, when I'm saying this, I like Tiger, I like Wonder Woman, I like the women in the skimpy outfits, but this one I could see is, you know, she's heroic, but she's still, I wouldn't be embarrassed if she was my mom.
No, of course not.
And she was, I don't know, the stories look cool, I like the idea, and it's not like, you don't have to shoehorn the story into something. Like Wonder Woman, sometimes they go, why would she come here? Why would she do that? You know, if she's an ambassador piece, why is she fighting everybody? You know what I mean? I don't know. It just fascinated me. I'd like to find some more stories. And she's in the public domain.
Go to digitalcomicsmuseum.com and join them, because you're going to have to join them.
Yeah, I have done that.
You'll find all that.
I have done that.
You'll find all that.
You know, actually, what I was hoping is maybe... Whoever takes care of Destination Nightmare could post some of her stories. I would love that.
I will.
I tell you.
Like I said, did you put on a Judy of the Jungle? Well, it was the entire book, but Judy of the Jungle's in there. There was another one that Matt Baker did called Canteen Kate that was really nice. It was an army one. That was a pretty good one. Yeah, there's a lot of that stuff.
You mentioned Matt Baker before. What did he do before, Judy of the Jungle?
His main book was Phantom Girl, Phantom Lady.
Oh, okay, yeah. Who they say was in the public domain, but then DC bought her.
DC owns Phantom Lady?
Yeah, because we talked about public domain heroes.
Yeah, we did.
She came up, and then I was looking her up for the blog, and it said that some people list her as public domain, but other sites said, yeah, they do, but be careful, because DC, I don't know. Public domain and copyrights are kind of... weird to me, because sometimes they could be in the, like in Europe, Popeye is in the public domain, but you can't say Popeye or use certain trademark things. But I think Phantom Lady, because I think DC published them. I think I read some of those when I was a kid, but I think they bought the copyright.
Well, I know DC bought the company, I don't know if it's Quality or one of the ones that had, well, they didn't buy them. They, well, I don't know, Shazam, yeah, Captain Marvel.
I thought that was Fawcett.
Yeah, Phantom Lady, but this, here's a weird thing about that. Those are considered in the public domain, the 40s ones. I guess after a certain point, because, again, Digital Comics Museum has all this stuff on there, and they claim it to be public domain.
Yeah.
So I don't know how DC can claim ownership of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't either, because I do know that Phantom Lady went to the public domain, but then, well, Thunder Agents is another one.
I've read that John Carbonaro supposedly owns...
Yeah.
Thunder Agents, because he's got a copyright by their name. I'll tell you a story about it, that later on after this show. I don't want to talk about it on the show.
Because I know that people were doing Thunder Agents. There wasn't just one group in the 80s. And then I guess they were shut down. But I thought Thunder Agents lapsed into it, but then...
They redid Thunder Agents recently.
Yeah.
I never bought them, but I'm pretty sure they redid them. I don't know who owns it now. It's kind of weird. There's like... estates of certain people that passed away, and then there's guys that are taking it, and you know, and stuff, and they've got LLCs by their name.
Yeah.
So,
well, Alan Moore said that when he did Marvel Man, he said I think it was Dez Skin was the guy that did Warrior Magazine. He didn't name the names. He just said that he was told that Marvel Man was in the public domain, and that's how he wrote all of his stories.
Yeah, because that happened in the 50s when the British had the Captain Marvel reprints, and then something, they lost it or something.
Yeah, and then Mick Anglo, who was doing the Captain Marvel stuff as well, they asked him to create Marvel Man, so he did. And because, England had a big demand for, or maybe the United Kingdom. But anyway, Mick Anglo did it, but the copyrights didn't lapse on Marvel Man, as Alan Moore was told. And Mick Anglo always had the copyright. He didn't.
And it got changed here to Miracle Man because Marvel Comics had the copyright to
Marvel,
it's incredible.
Yeah, well, I don't know. That's when Captain Marvel, they had to call him the original Captain Marvel, and the title was Shazam,
Yeah, right. Shazam, yeah.
Yeah, well, that one, I don't know, but...
Yeah, because the Marvel's Captain Marvel is, it is what it is. It's the one that they could actually use the name for whatever reason. Yeah, we've talked about...
But, Senorita Rito, she could straighten all this out if she was still with us.
I have a reprint book somewhere called Rio Rita, and I don't know if that's Senorita. I don't know if it's her or not, but she was an adventuress like her.
Well, if she wasn't, they should team up together.
That would be nice.
Anyway, that's what I got. I just wanted to bring to the table because glamorous fighting ladies of the 40s, I just can't get enough of.
Yeah, bring them on.
Yeah, the jungle ladies.
Find some more, we'll talk about
them. The jungle ladies, the adventure ladies, the crime fighting ladies.
It's funny. Remember Rima, the...
Yeah.
Jungle Girl.
Which is a good book.
Right. Well, I was looking through, whatchamacallit? I forgot how I got it. I saw a movie poster for a movie called Green Mansions, which looks like it's like some romance. And apparently Rima, the Jungle Girl, came from the novel Green Mansions, which got made into a movie. Yeah. And you know who played Rima, the Jungle Girl, in Green Mansions?
No.
Audrey Hepburn.
No way.
I'm serious. And I think it was more of a jungle gothic romance or something. I don't know, but that's where Rima the Jungle Girl comes from, which I had no clue until I was looking at the poster. And then I was reading about it. It said, oh, yeah, Audrey Hepburn in the late 50s or whatever. So go figure. I don't know. Audrey Hepburn was a jungle girl. There you go.
Well, now I've got to find this movie.
Green Mansions.
Green Mansions.
It's based on a famous novel. I can't think of the writer, but well, you'll find it this week. Anyway, I was just reading. I was going through my books, and then I had forgotten about this book called Freak Show by Bruce Jones and Bernie Wrightson. I guess as his image put it out, it's a collection, but it was first, in heavy metal?
That's where I saw it. It was in heavy metal in, 1981 or 82.
And I guess it was serialized.
In heavy metal, it was,
for a few issues or something like that.
And it was in color.
Which is, it looks great in black and white, but it was I'd forgotten about it. So I was like, oh, let me take a look at that. That's kind of cool. It's easy to read. It's actually very good. It really reads like a long Warren story, pretty much. Especially because, of course, Bruce Jones and Bernie Wrightson are the guys that brought you your favorite disgusting horror story, Jennifer.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, and this book is kind of like a tribute to the movie Freaks in a way. It's basically a guy who runs around and bringing a freak show to town or whatever.
Yeah.
And then it talks about how, he found all these people in towns or whatever, these outcasts or whatever, freak, and basically he would bring them and turn them into the shows and people could see them, and at least they found a place of belonging or whatever. And then he met some woman who was her husband died and she was running through the woods and she was running away from a bunch of weird freaky people, and he found her and he saved her and she became his wife and his she ran the freak show with him. And then everybody got along, those two. They cared for the freaks, and they took them to town or whatever. And then somewhere along the way, the husband and wife, the man and the woman that he had saved, she had a kid. She got pregnant, and then she went into she was getting ready to have the kid. She was going into a really bad labor, so he started drinking again because he was freaking out. He didn't know what to do, so he got real drunk. And then all of a sudden, hours later, one of the freaks, I think it was a frog girl or whatever.
Yeah, she was the main one.
Yeah, yeah, right. You remember, she comes up to him. She goes, "Oh, look, a new baby." And he shows the baby to him, and the baby's a frog baby. And he's like, "What?" And he's drunk, and he's freaking out. And he's like, "Who, you mean she was messing around with one of you?" And he runs and he torches the freak cabin. And everybody, and the woman, everybody he sets it on fire and he runs away, and he's despondent for years. He becomes a drunk, and he's a real mess for many years. And all of a sudden, one day he comes across, he's in one of his drunken stupors, comes across some woman who's kind of a surgeon, but she's also a healer, or even if she's not religious, and she kind of helps him get back. And she goes through all these towns helping people, saving them, either by, religion or by medicine or whatever. And he falls in love with this woman, but she doesn't want to marry him. So then at some point towards the end, they see this wagon, and she goes, "Oh, let's go there. Maybe we can help somebody." And he's like, "Wait a minute, that looks like a freak wagon." I'm not going to tell you I'm not going to spoil it, but it's kind of an interesting ending. But it is a tribute to the movie Freaks. It's a good book.
It's good.
It's good. It's really good rights and art. It's a good creepy type story. I just read it. I think it's a lot of fun. It's probably out of print, but I'm sure you could find that on Amazon or whatever.
I would think, because the image, I think if it's an image book, it's got to be available.
Yeah, but it was kind of fun. Again, it was a serialized in heavy metal. But I think even though this has a 2006 copyright, I think this storyline was from before that.
I was just reading the back of the thing Bruce Jones was talking about. It was in between him doing Alien Worlds and Twisted Tales for Pacific Comics.
So was it in the 90s maybe or something?
No, it was because he ran in heavy metal. Oh, this book?
No, this book is from 2006, original.
It was in 81 or 82.
It was that old?
Yeah, because I was reading heavy metal, because that's when Starstruck was being serialized in heavy metal as well. which it was to me a thrill because, again, I love the studio guys.
Well, I didn't realize this was from the early
and
days.
I remember my buddy Brett had said, we were looking through it, and he said, well, Kaluta's just as good as he ever was. The Freak Show stuff was good. It, actually, looking at this, it's a lot better than I remembered it.
It looks a lot better in black and white.
Yes. He hit the nail on the head. The color in heavy metal was good on this story, but you lose a lot of Bernie. Like sometimes you see the backsides of people, the capes, and it's not just a black background. I mean, he's got it hatched in quite masterfully.
Yeah.
But, I'm looking through there, and I mean, it's got all the faces and stuff that Bernie Wrightson did so well. He's really good at drawing misshapen bodies.
Yeah, Swamp Thing.
Yeah, it was like the old Swamp Thing strip. And when I'm reading this, you know, sometimes in heavy metal, when it's serialized, you're not really sure exactly how much you've read when the next one comes out, and you're a little confused. When I'm reading this, I guess I did read all the pages, but... Yeah, it all came back. It was a great story.
And yeah, it was a good story. I remember having the issues, but I probably never read it. I'm
you know,
glad
the,
I found it.
The main character always reminded me of, you mentioned a religious feel. That's absolutely, he felt like a guy that was going town to town, like, you know, doing tent revivals and stuff, and like a real zealot, really, you know, and really ready to point fingers at people doing wrong, and then next thing you know, he's got his own demons.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And, that's really, 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 really nice work. Well, he did Creepshow around that time, too.
Yeah, because this looks like Creepshow. Right. Creepshow, I have the graphic novel.
Yeah, it looks nicer than Creepshow. Creepshow, to me, is like Bernie Rice with one hand tied behind his back. For some reason, he wasn't putting as much work in the Creepshow as he did the other stuff. But that one, sometimes his artwork got a little softer, except for Frankenstein.
Yeah.
You know, but that one, it's still, that's worth getting. That's that was a neat story.
And the last thing was something that has nothing, it's not comic book related, but I just found it in the midst of all this stuff that I had it. Again, you know, I have a few of these, but I forgot that I had this one. This was like, they came out with these like in the late 80s maybe. It was these little, I think they're French. Well, they're actually in French and English, okay. They're called, what are they called? Horror Pictures Collection. It's basically like, this guy, Gerald Noll, did like all the, you know, a lot of the B movie guys, like Christopher Lee, Peter Cushing, Barbara Steele, and he did these little, like, fan editions with a lot of kind of like, somewhat rare, you know, European.
Yeah, wow, look at that.
Pictures or whatever.
And posters, too.
Yeah, and these are a lot of fun, man. I've forgotten about these. I have a Barbara Steele one, Abbott and Costello one, but a lot of these pictures in here are European photos.
Well,
not all, but a lot
too.
Of them. And I've never seen them before. There's a whole series of them.
That's a nice book.
And they're a lot of fun.
That's
you know?
Really nice.
Yeah, they're from the early days. That's completely forgotten about. I don't know how many they came out with, but I do remember getting them when I was running the comic shop. And I just found that today. I was like, oh my God, I didn't remember I had. I know I have an Al Adamson, a Barbara Steele, an Abbott and Costello, a few other, you know, classic horror people like that, but,
1992.
92, okay. There you go.
Yeah, when you held it up, the reproduction is just second to none, but remember those little TV guides just to get out of the newspaper?
Yeah,
that's
it's
what
like,
it looked
that's what
like.
It looks like. Yeah, it's like a little digest or something.
But it has really high quality. It's got, Christopher Lee on the front, I guess that's Dracula.
Sure.
Christopher Lee one more time. But the inside, it's a lot of it's black and white, but it's pristine printing.
It's beautiful copies of stuff. And I think it's, like I said, I think it's pictures that I've never seen before on a lot of these.
Yeah. This is my favorite one, though, is the poster of Horror Dracula.
Oh, yeah, it's a beautiful poster, yeah.
But it's got all kinds of stills and all kinds of captions in French, which unfortunately
God, I haven't been to a movie in so long. These, when you go to the movies, because you go every once in a while.
Oh yeah,
they still have a movie poster.
Yeah,
they do still make movie posters.
Yeah, but
oh, that's right. But they're very dark and grim now.
Oh, sometimes there are a lot of photographs, but yeah, they do. What I liked was, I don't know now. I'm trying to think, but a lot of times you come out of the theater and the posters, like if it was at the mall or something, the posters would be in the passageway before you got to the lobby.
Okay.
And I never noticed them until we were leaving. And sometimes they have the actual movie you saw, or sometimes they have upcoming movies in those posters.
They still make posters, okay.
But they have those big stand-up displays most of the time now. I mean, sometimes they're huge and elaborate, like they're taller than I am, and like they're wide. And they have fabric banners hanging up from the ceiling, because, you know, they're usually like, you know, big, giant, two-story, you know, ceilings. So sometimes I don't notice them as much, but I think sometimes they have them outside too, framed, you know, for the current movies.
I don't think I've been in a movie theater in like 8 years. Well, I'm not kidding.
Our friend Scott Connor was just telling me he went to see Tarzan the other day, that new Tarzan movie.
Is it new Tarzan?
Yeah, it's Tarzan. I can't remember the other one, but you know, one.
Is it a live action?
Yeah.
Or a cartoon?
No,
live
it's
action?
A live action. I'll tell you one thing, you know. You can make the worst movie in the world. If you put Tarzan in it, I'm probably going to go see it. I mean, I just like Tarzan. And I was interested, and then my wife and I went to see some other movie. I can't remember what it was now, but they had the trailer for it. And I told my wife, I kind of want to see that. But then when they showed the trailer, I mean, it looked good. You know, the guy who played Tarzan looked kind of neat. But to me, the CGI of him swinging around and the animals and stuff, they went too far. And I was saying this, I love Lord of the Rings. I love the John Carter movie, and that was CGI palooza. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, it was believable CGI to me, even though it's, you know, kind of over the top, but it worked. Sometimes you can do CGI. It's like electronic, you know, records in the 70s, sometimes the guys didn't tune it and they just went crazy and you're ring, 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 all the time and you're like, oh, please, you know. But Scott told me he saw it and he says, I really liked it. And then he, you know, I told him what I thought and he goes, no, I says, I agree with you on the CGI sometimes, but this one was fine. One question I asked him, was it just another Tarzan origin story? And he goes, well, they showed the origin elements in it throughout, but he told me the story. Oh, that's neat. You know, it's not just another Tarzan origin story movie. I look at it, if you want to see Tarzan's origin, watch Greystoke. And that'll tell you all you need to know. That's one of my favorite movies. But I do appreciate him putting the origin in it. You kind of need that in a movie. But he said he really liked it. And then he sent me a bunch of reviews. I guess it's one of those cases where the critics hate it and tore it to pieces. Mm. I'm guessing like John Carter, but I've read a lot of people loved it and want to see it. And again, I think a lot of people like me, if you got Tarzan in it, you know. Yeah, this book here is sweet.
That's from a Jekyll and Hyde movie that he did called I, Monster.
Most of the stuff in here I've never seen, ever.
I've never seen a lot of these pictures. And you know what? I just remembered something. Speaking of like Jungle Girls. I have a few of the movies in the 60s, European, you know, movies. They kind of brought back that whole Jungle Girl thing, except like in in these ones, they weren't wearing anything. They just had long hair covering, you know, and there was like, I know I have one called Gungala, and there was one of the things, it was called Tarzana or whatever, so that was very popular in the 60s in Europe or whatever. Of course, they took it to, you know. And I seem to remember there was one that I had somewhere called Leanne, Jungle Goddess or whatever. So that never really went away. It just kind of like, you know.
You know, my daughter was little. She had a character called Jungle Girl.
Yeah.
And she was in pre-K and she used to make books, you know, fold paper in half and she'd draw a story. And I said, what is this, a bug? No, it's Jungle Girl. And it was a vine with this girl swinging on it. And she had a little house on stilts with a really pristine vegetable garden next to it. But she lived in the jungle, and as she got older, she continued to draw her. And she looked kind of like a Filipina jungle girl. You know, she had kind of the brownish peanut butter skin. And her name was Bianca as she got older. Jungle Girl's actual name was Bianca.
Okay.
And she had out-of-control hair. And at one point, she drew a comic story where another girl showed up as an explorer, you know, with pith helmet and everything, and she had a Jeep. And at one point, Jungle Girl drove the Jeep, and she was a reckless driver. I thought, well, of course, she lives in the jungle. How would she learn to drive? And at one point, they got in a plane and flew, and when they landed, Jungle Girl jumped out and was kissing the ground because she grew up in the jungle. She didn't like flying. So I guess even little girls like Jungle Girls.
Everybody does.
Yeah, so I don't know of any Jungle Girl in the Tarzan movie, nor should there be, but in comic Jane. Books, she was.
Yeah, she was.
Who was your favorite Jean in the movies?
I would say the first one.
Yeah, me too.
You know, Mia Farrow's mom, I can't think of her name right now.
I can't think of it either. I have it right on.
Yeah, it's on the tip of my tongue.
Yeah, we'll stop thinking about it and pop. And, she was always the one, I remember, we lived in Utah, and they used to show those late at night, and my mom would watch them all the time, and then when I was, I think I was 10, I was in Graham, Texas over a summer, and they had Young Adult Theater, I guess it was the Dallas TV station.
Really? Young Adult Theater?
It was in the afternoons, like on Sunday.
I have to look this up, by the way.
But they always played the Tarzan movies. You know, the Johnny Weissmullers.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, Jane had blonde hair. And all the, I'd do anything for the lady with the golden hair. They'd always say, you know, the kids and stuff. When did Jane have blonde hair? Because I remember the dark hair. Then I was telling Mom about it, and she goes, oh, I don't like her. I remember, you know, she mentioned that actress's name. I like the dark hair. Yeah, there was a dark hair Jane. She was in the first three movies.
Maureen O'Sullivan?
Yeah, Maureen O'Sullivan.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. She was Mia Farrow's mom. But yeah, she was, to me, she was Tara, you know, she was Jean.
And then the uncut version.
Yeah, she swam naked.
Yeah, I mean, it was like, whoa, I don't remember seeing that when I was watching Tarzan Theater on Channel 33 back then.
No, yeah. They cut it out, and then I rented it from a Hollywood Video on videotape, and it was the uncut. Wow!
But it's the same thing they did with Kong. Kong in the uncut version, he's eating natives and stuff like that. And the version I saw when I was a kid, I didn't see him like eating their heads off. I just saw him like grabbing them or whatever. You know, they really edited the hell out of these.
Well, see, I saw that one, the drive-in, I think in the summer of 71 or 72. And, you know, my parents took me to see it, and they were delighted. It was a great film, but they said in the paper it was the first time the whole uncut thing has been shown since like 19, I don't know what the year was.
30 something.
Yeah.
Now you liked you when getting back to Kong or whatever. You liked the 1976 Kong, right? Dino Kong.
I do like that one
because it was on TV yesterday on.
Well, the thing was
local channel.
I saw that when it came out. You know, it was the winter of 76, and I loved it. I thought it was a great movie.
Oh, I see the new Tarzan. I've seen that picture before. I just didn't pay much attention to him. Okay.
But I wondered how that movie would age. And then when the Peter Jackson Tarzan was coming out, I guess AMC showed that Dino De Laurentiis Tarzan from 76. And I watched it, and I said, I mean, I understand it's a movie from 76. It has this dated quote, but to me, it still stood up. I enjoyed it. It was worth watching. And then when you and Mal did it on Slow Roll About a Go-Go, you just groaned the whole time, and then you gave it a rating of 5. And I went and told you how wrong you were. And you said, what would you have rated it? 5? That's what I gave it. Yeah, I agree. We both give it the same rating, but to me it wasn't a bad movie. If it was on TV...
On yesterday. I didn't watch it, though. It was on yesterday.
But I'm just telling people, listen to this. If it comes on TV and you don't have anything pressing, it's worth watching. I wouldn't go out and buy the DVD...
It was Maureen O'Sullivan, I forget that name.
But, you know, all I can think of is that if a Jungle Girl was in the King Kong movie, he wouldn't have died. She would have saved him.
You know, the thing about Dino Kong is I didn't see it when I was a kid. So I just kind of I kind of compare it to what I did see. And it was just kind of like, but, you know, I may have to watch it again and read about it. I could have watched it yesterday, actually. It's funny, they played a Christopher Lee Dracula movie that was from 1970 called Count Dracula, which was supposedly the most, directed by Jess Franco, the most original, faithful, and it really wasn't, but that was their hype or whatever. It's kind of watching, I go, that's kind of cool that it's on TV, and then they played Dino Kong, but I just kind of like, I forgot to watch it or whatever, but I should give it another chance. Why the hell not? You know, maybe we'll do like a slow robot show where we reevaluate movies that
That's the
before.
Concept.
Did you listen to what happened to us a few weeks ago?
No, I'm way behind on you guys now.
I'll tell you what happened, which is kind of funny. We both picked. Okay, I picked a movie called. How did it happen? It was either I picked a movie called Slumber Party Massacre 2. Okay, because it was like an actress that you know. I was like, oh man, I want to see her in this movie. So, and she was only in the second one. So he picked what was the movie that he picked? I can't remember right now. So anyway, around the middle of the week, I forgot what movie it was. I go, do you remember what movie I picked? And he goes, yeah, Slumber Party Massacre 2. Oh yeah, and I go, oh okay. So I went to the computer and instead of Slumber Party Massacre, I got Sorority House Massacre 2. So when I got to the show, and he's like, oh man, that movie really stunk, and he starts describing it. I go, wait a minute. I watched a different movie than you, so he watched Slumber Party Massacre 2, and I watched Sorority House Massacre 2. So he described one movie, and we were like laughing our butts off. So the next thing he goes, okay, you watch mine, I'll watch yours.
Oh, that's awesome.
It was by accident.
Yeah, well, you know, I could see that because sometimes you've told me that they changed the names when they
yeah,
re-released
them. He told me, he wrote what it was, and in my brain, I went Sorority House Massacre because there's like so many number two movies or whatever. So, yeah. Yeah, we did that one the other day, and I digress, but anyway.
That sounds good. Well,
are we done?
I think we could keep going, but I think we need to stop. Anyway, thanks for listening, everybody. I hope you enjoyed your 4th of July, which is going to be coming up in a couple of days.
That's right.
Do you have anything else you want to push out?
Let me think. Is there anything I want to say? Well, just, you know, watch and listen to all our shows, you know, Slow Robot and Two Dimension and Kung Fu Theater.
Yeah,
and,
is the Kung Fu Theater, as he finally put it, because I checked.
It's on Archives. According to Martin, he archives it now. It's on RadioSt.Pete.com.
Yeah. I'll check, because I went to the Bunch of Dorks link itself, and I didn't see.
It's only through Radio St. Pete. No. Martin has not archived it through our.
Okay, all right. Well, that's I was going to listen to it there.
Yeah, so we got a bunch of those. What did we do this week? We watched Half a Loaf of Kung Fu with Jackie Chan.
Yeah, that's a good one.
It's a funny movie, but it's all over the place. I had a hard time with the plot, but it was funny.
That's the one with the scrolls, right? He's learning all the lessons on a scroll. Yeah,
he's fighting somebody and he's got the scrolls. Well, let me try the scissors move or whatever.
Yeah, and he drops them and the guy's beating the living crap out of him and then he just bends down. Oh, kick! Yeah, it's just awesome.
Yeah, that's funny stuff.
And that guy, he's like a homeless beggar, and that's his instructor.
Yeah, you remember it.
Yeah, it was one of my favorites.
Okay.
And, I mean, I understand it's an earlier movie, but then another guy shows up hanging out, and he always has those really bad farts, and that's one
yeah,
of the instructor's
master,
main students.
Yeah. And then that weird intro and credit sequence where he's imitating Blind Swordsman and all this. I mean, it's a Jesus Christ Superstar thing. It's a very strange movie. Anyway, that's on Kung Fu Theater this week.
Well, now you know what to look for. Also, we didn't talk about Jungle Girls enough. Al's posted on Destination Nightmare, which I will be checking out when I go home today.
Yeah, I'll put today. I already did one today. I can't remember what it was.
But you said you put Judy the Jungle? Or?
That was yesterday.
Okay, well.
So you can see Judy the Jungle.
Yeah.
July 1st.
Do you post every day on that?
Try to.
Okay, see, I mean, I went to it frequently, but I didn't realize they were every day.
Pretty much.
Of course,
I mean,
you know, when I
screw up every once in a while.
When I go on it, I mean, I scroll down I'm on that site for a long time, so.
Some people post less, but they write more. I write less and post more. I think that's better for everybody.
All right.
Man, that's
anyway, thank you very much. And in the meantime,
read more comics.
Giant fearsome stranger.
You can find Al's other podcast, Slow Robot A Go-Go, Dallas's webcomic, The Mighty Blue, and Al's blog, Destination Nightmare, on the sidebar of our blog at bunchofdorks.com.
And click on the Cyclops!